Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 235 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by co-host Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to everyone. It's now, Max, I'm actually glad to hear that you're there. We were a little concerned when we heard that Connecticut had 11 feet of snow, I think, or something, the media reported.
Almost, I may have gotten
those numbers off just a little bit.
They're pretty close. 30 inches, a lot of snow. I think this is the third episode now where we've opened up talking about the weather. So we'll try to move right along. And
especially since we have a couple of ladies as guests tonight, we don't want to make them think that this is what our dating life used to be like, even though it was.
Even though it kind of was.
Yeah.
Also co-hosting is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hi. I can safely say we don't have any snow, so welcome, everyone.
Well, as Rob mentioned, we have two guests this episode, a returning guest and a new guest. Our returning guest is Linda Meeks. She's the executive director of Girls with Wings. Linda, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Now, you've got a few changes coming in your life that we might want to touch on in a little bit later in the show, but things are changing for you, aren't they?
They are quite a bit, and good cliffhanger right there.
Okay, that's called a teaser. Also joining us is Jody Bromer. Now, if that name sounds a little familiar, that's because this is the same Jody who has written us before. Jody's a listener of the podcast. She's provided some photos that we've posted on airplanegeeks.com. Jody was with the U.S. Navy Seabees, which is a combat construction group. And I also understand she served as a convoy 240B gunner in Iraq with 143 missions. Well, Jody, after her enlistment, has decided that she wants to fly helicopters and has enrolled in a helicopter school in Salt Lake City under the GI Bill. Jody, it's great to have you on the show.
Yes, thank you so much.
Jody, have you and Linda not talked about helicopters before?
I mean, you couldn't
talk her out of it?
I didn't find out till, I think, 231 that she was a prior Black Hawk pilot when you guys were talking to Steve.
Actually, just Hueys.
Hueys. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that most of us women don't throw around our ratings like some other people do.
Exactly. So.
Linda's back.
Okay. We won't be as nice to you when you go.
Go ahead, bring it on.
We're going to go to tell us about later.
All right. Well, this is going to prove to be an interesting one. I can tell that already. We can talk about helicopters. We can also talk about another interest Jody and Linda have that we share as well, which is women in aviation. And we are going to talk about something that is sponsored by the Institute for Women of Aviation Worldwide. This is coming up in the near future, the 2013 Women of Aviation Worldwide Week. And so we'll look forward to talking about that coming up. But we've also got some aviation news. And David, we have an aircraft of the week, don't we?
We do. We're going to be a little rebellious and talk about vigilantes.
Ooh.
And Peter has a cool segment this week.
Peter's Across the Pond segment is very interesting, very different. It's just Peter. He doesn't have a guest this time, but he's going to talk about a recent aviation event, and he's got some questions for us, actually for Rob. And, of course, we have the Australia Desk from Steve and Grant. All right, well, let's get right into it. Is everyone ready?
Yes.
All right, well, another week has gone by, and so it's probably time again to talk about the U.S. Airways and American Airlines merger. This is kind of difficult to keep up with. Things are changing pretty quickly. They're still working out the merger details, and the news keeps coming in faster than we can keep up with it. But it's looking stronger and stronger, more likely that we're going to see the merger take place this month in February, maybe even as soon as a week. What do you think, Rob? Looks like it's going to be a go.
Well, it certainly looks that way. There are still things that could derail it, but of course, the Justice Department today actually said that it would most likely, I shouldn't say it was a spokesman that used to work for the Justice Department that added her expertise to a conversation and said that she couldn't imagine any reason why the antitrust folks would not approve the merger as it stands right now. Hmm. It's my guess this is probably going to happen. And again, I really do believe, though, that the word on the street is that the government will approve it. There won't be any antitrust issues. But again, I really do believe, too, that everyone is starting to realize that neither of these two airlines on their own are going to be nearly as viable as they will be if they get together.
Yeah, I don't know of anybody that's against this, except maybe the competition. But the creditors committee also has to approve the merger plan. But there again, you know, why wouldn't they?
That's right. And I think there have been more reasons for people to agree than disagree at this point. But, you know, we'll see.
Now, I read in one article that the combined airline, if in fact it does go through, would retain American Airlines' name.
Well, I hope so. They spent all that time with that new logo for America. I mean, you know, they've already started painting airplanes and good grief. I figured somehow they knew.
But if you look at that logo and then put it next to a U.S. Airbird,
yeah,
they're awfully close.
They sure are.
And basically, it's American Airlines adopting the U.S. Air flag. But it's good news for us here in PHL. I mean, we'll have a real airline again as a major contributor to the airport, since the majority of the airport is still run by U.S. Airways. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to American Airlines coming in.
Go ahead, Linda. That's right.
Well, I had a question because Doug Parker's going to take over as CEO, but Tom Horton's so who's making out on this? Is this a U.S. Airways deal or is this really American Airlines?
Well, didn't they give Tom Horton some sort of strange
executive chairman of the board or something like that?
Yeah, some bizarre title. So.
Yeah, a non-executive position as chairman of the board, I think it was.
What does that mean? Has anybody ever heard of that before?
Well, and they said it has its time allowed, so whether or not they decide to keep it is all up to the board, I guess.
Maybe it means he's on probation with the new airline.
Sounds like it.
I mean, and what did you do before you worked for American? Well, actually, I was the CEO. Uh-huh. And do you have references for that, Mr. Horton?
But you know, there is a job opportunity for him. Because if anyone who has seen the newest H&R Block commercials, I think it is, and yeah. the one guy wearing a bow tie admits that for 30 years he was a chief executive officer before he became a local tax attorney. So evidently H&R Block will hire anyone to do your tax.
Jeez. Oh, my. Okay. Well, there's opportunities everywhere, right? You just have to look for them.
Yeah, I think it's going to be, we keep hearing it's going to be soon, but I think it'll happen when it happens, and I don't think anybody can predict it.
Yeah.
And how long do you think it'll be before there's a three-way argument with the pilots union? Since we are getting U.S. Airways, or do you think the merger with American will be the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
Well, that's an interesting point, and I think that when you look back at the last few months, of course, the American pilots went out of their way, both pilot groups really did, to try to come up with some sort of an agreement before any deal was going to take place. But of course, your point is well taken, David. I mean, the U.S. Airways and the America West guys still do not get along. And how this is going to work, I don't even know.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eye on the news, and maybe by the time that this comes out or people are listening to this, we'll have the answers. And I guess if not, we'll talk about it some more next week. All right, our next story. Google to begin work on their own private airport in San Jose. This is from droidlife.com. David, you must have found droidlife.com.
Why? Yeah, I did. All right.
All right. I figured it must have been you.
I was working for that damn boss of mine, and I found this article, and I thought it was actually kind of humorous. So.
It's interesting. This is about a little $82 million project to build a private 29-acre airport for Google's fleet and maybe some other things as well. And it's not tiny. It's supposed to be able to handle a Boeing 737 and a 767.
I hope so, because that's what Google has.
Those guys,
I was going to say, it better have a long runway.
Yeah, this is at Mineta San Jose International Airport.
So really, they're really just building a terminal, not a whole airport.
Not with runways and all. It's a joint venture between Signature Flight Support, which people may have heard of, and Blue City Holdings. It's a company that operates the planes that are the private aircraft of the Google guys, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, and also the chairman, Eric Schmidt. I guess this project is a little bit bigger than just Google, that they're hoping to attract other private aircraft that may be attracted to this facility. But Rob, are you familiar with the Signature Flight Support?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
They are
big FBO,
a large FBO chain. They're owned by a group out in the United Kingdom. In fact, when I was – well, we have a little segment tonight that I did with a couple of local Chicago podcasters, and we did it from the FBO at Signature Flight Support up at Chicago Executive. So I'm very familiar with Signature, as I'm sure is Linda.
I've been there once or twice.
Yeah, go for the cookies.
Oh, yeah, very nice FBOs, very very lush.
So
plush.
So how do you folks that are pilots, which I guess is all of you except for David and myself, what makes for a good FBO?
Cookies,
food.
Little Dan would say that cookies also make an airline, but well
that's true. Yeah, yeah.
If you have cookies and popcorn, you have a full meal. So definitely a pilot lounge, you know, separate from everything else, so you can get a snooze in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you need to rest some.
Yep.
How about you, Jody? Have you spent much time in FBOs?
Well, really, it's the additional services they can give you. So the car ride into town or the hangar for your jet or whatnot seems to be the big selling point for a nice FBO.
They never offered me a hangar for my jet. I mean, no, seriously, I mean, the snooze rooms, the comfy chairs, ability to grab a car or a ride to go get something to eat, because corporate pilots spend their life at the FBO waiting for their passengers who are always late. I mean, and if they're not late, you don't know they're early until somebody sticks their head in and says, hey, can we go now? Oh, jeez, you know. So, a comfy FBO is a great place.
Hmm. Especially those with good crew food.
Ah, yes.
Now we keep coming back to the food. What is
I know. I skipped dinner. I'm hungry.
Okay.
I don't actually care about the food.
What?
Much. Much. I mean, I like certain kinds of cookies and, you know, that sort of thing. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, that. And in fact, that's the fun part about traveling as a corporate pilot. When you're going to a particular FBO and you ask somebody else, they'll go, oh, yeah, and make sure you ask them about. Or tell them you want to go too, and we all share restaurant tips and things like that. Because everybody knows how miserable it can be to have to spend too much time at an FBO. So it has to be comfy.
When you're flying to the commercial terminals, you're really kind of stuck there for the most part. So it's nice to go to an FBO that when you walk up, they've got a crew car available and they've got a list of restaurants, and they really just kind of take care of you. And so it makes you know, a place where you might be potentially sitting the whole day waiting for your passengers. You know, it's not so bad.
Well, it's interesting because we haven't talked about FBOs, I don't think, in the past. Maybe we should look for a guest, someone from the FBO world that can give us some insight into what that part of the aviation business is like.
That's an interesting point, though. There's a new lady that just took over the CEO role for Signature here in the States.
Oh.
Maybe we can find her.
Let's ring her up.
Yeah.
All right. Well, while we're waiting for that to happen, we can move on. This is a story on the 787. 787 completes first battery test flight. And this is from Liam News. I guess, well, we don't know a lot about what happened, right? I mean, they flew a 787 in some kind of a pattern with a load of engineers and technicians and such, and looked to see what happened, I guess. And we don't really know if anything happened, do we?
Well, we know nothing bad happened, I think, but that's about all.
Mm-hmm. It was rather anticlimactic.
Mm-hmm. And of course, once they replaced the Duracells, they realized that was the problem. They put the copper tops in there, and 787 just. But actually, they did approve in Asia. They approved the flight of a couple of Indian Airlines 787s to get them moved from where they were back to a maintenance base. And the last I heard, I don't know if FAA approved it, but they must have. Yeah, right, because they were doing the test. FAA did have some limited options for moving 787s, and I don't think it included regular movements, but just an occasional one, which, again, must have been this test now that I think about it.
Though I will say this. This article has, or I should say, this topic has pervaded even general culture. I was sort of surprised when at dinner on Saturday night with my brother-in-law and sister-in-law, who really have nothing to do with aviation, started asking me, what's up with the batteries on the 787? Huh. I've also got it in the office. What's up? I don't understand. So clearly the media is getting the message out that there's a problem with the 787, and it's not just the av geeks or the airplane geeks that are following it, but the general public also.
What's worrisome is that how Boeing has pretty much no PR response to this at all. There's no damage control going on. They're just saying they don't know.
Yeah, that's really true. And that is a scary response when you think that the best they can come up with is no response. And that just doesn't go anywhere. Of course, honestly, they don't have anything to say. I mean, there's nothing for them to tell the media because they don't have any updates. And trust me, if they knew and they could fix it, those airplanes would be flying.
Oh, you bet. You bet. Absolutely.
I can't even imagine how much this is going to probably cost Boeing before these airplanes get back in the air with all the penalties and all the other things.
This is shaping up to be a big financial hit for Boeing, or maybe their insurance company. I'm not sure how that works, but yeah, the operators, the airlines are certainly, you know, have to incur all kinds of expenses to compensate for this. They have to get capacity from somewhere else, and that doesn't come cheap.
Well, thank God they're not making the 787 into a tanker. Because that would be a living hell for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, pretty soon we get to start talking about the A350 because that's moving along closer to first flight, and I guess that's the next new aircraft coming down the line that is going to be followed by, you know, by everyone to see if they have development problems or other kinds of issues come up, you know, associated with a new aircraft.
Well, they sure know they're going to have the battery issue figured out by then.
Well, I bet they're really checking their math. We've seen in a couple of articles that the A350 also uses lithium ion batteries. But we've also heard from Airbus in the press that they have enough time, enough flexibility that they can, you know, they can change that if they feel they need to. But I bet their engineers are, if they had slide rules, they'd have their slide rules out and checking those sums pretty carefully to make sure that everything that they've planned for is adequate.
Max, you realize you're dating yourself. Half the people listening to the show don't even know what a slide rule is.
I used to have a slide rule, but
I still have one, actually.
Do you?
Yeah. I have mine from my father.
Yeah? Is it one of those nice ivory or whatever they used to make those things out of, or that
it
comes with the case, and it also had like a protractor this, you know, it's a whole
Linda and Jody don't know what we're talking about.
Well, no, I actually do know. I'm just looking at the title of this podcast and really understanding why.
I do know, but only in second person.
Yeah, you see them in museums maybe.
Well, and when we were in high school, you were really cool if you had a slide rule in a cool sort of burgundy case and you hung it from your belt.
Leather, right? A leather case.
Yeah, and it was kind of burgundy colored. And Chris, I wonder if that had anything to do with our dating problems. No, you wouldn't care, right, Linda? Jody, you wouldn't care if a guy had a slide rule hanging from his belt. That would still be cool, wouldn't it?
Oh, don't forget your pocket protector there.
Oh, yeah. No, I wouldn't wear a pocket protector. That's pretty geeky.
You were the one with the ink stains on your shirt then.
Very good.
Okay.
Yeah, Jody's got you figured out, Rob.
Yeah. We'll talk later.
All right. Well, we have one more story. Actually, this is something that Rob popped in here at the last minute.
I just thought it was so interesting that someone was actually talking about space flight, and I grabbed it when it came in off the wire, and I just had to mention the fact that there's a group out there that is promoting men generically, as in guys,
humans.
Thank you. Putting humans in spacecraft and sending them to Mars. Didn't President Bush say something about that a couple of years ago?
Well, we started to go down that path, and then we kind of pulled back. So, yeah, this group is exploremars.org, and they've done a survey along with Phillips and Company. This Explore Mars group, it's a nonprofit, and, you know, as Rob says, they're their objective is to advance the cause for human exploration of Mars. And they released preliminary findings of a survey. Now, this is a survey of, I think it said about 1,000, maybe a little bit more than that, of folks in the United States. And they were looking to see what people's opinions were about the exploration of Mars. And this poll finds that 71% of Americans are confident that humans will go to Mars by 2033. That's 71%. Wow, I wouldn't have guessed it would have been that high.
Well, we, of course, don't know how they developed the sample, but still, I think you will find so many Americans that, despite all the other issues that we have always wondered why we somehow took this exploration aspect of our lives, of our culture in North America here, and just kind of threw it in the garbage can. And I don't mean anything terrible to the folks that work so hard to put, say, the Mars rover and a few other things on those planets, but it's still culturally probably about people. Hmm. And so I think that there are blankets of these folks out there that just hope that somehow this is going to come back, and maybe this is just kind of a leading edge. I mean, I'd love to do it. Heck, I would have gone for a ride in the shuttle in a heartbeat.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we need some excitement back into the space program. I mean, yeah, the Mars rovers are extremely, at least to me, you know, fascinating, and that's, that's great science, and it's, you know, great stuff, but there's nothing like, you know, sending a human being to Mars or to an asteroid or to back to the moon or to some place like that. I might mention that, if you're interested in this topic, and if you haven't heard Peter Johnson's last episode of the extended podcast, it's a long one, and it's all about space. And he does have some, he and his co-hosts have some great interviews, some fascinating interviews. If you're a space buff or interested in some of the history of that and some of the future of that, go listen to Peter's podcast. It's really a great episode. So, Rob, what's your feeling? You think we're going to go to Mars? 2033. Why did they pick 2033?
because that was far enough away that no one will remember that anybody said 2033.
Okay. Max? So,
yeah, David.
20 years from 2013 is what?
Oh, it's 2013. I keep forgetting. Yeah, okay, all right. Sorry. I guess when you put it that way, it's sort of obvious.
Yes, the historian for once does math correctly.
All right.
But I'll tell you something funny. Of course, as most of you know, my daughter is graduating from high school in a couple of months, yeah. And all these kids are starting to get college offers already about where, you know, they're going to go here, they're going to go there, and one of her close friends has applied to Stanford. I don't know that she's going to get in, but when we talked about what she wanted to be when she grew up, she said, "I want to be an astrophysicist," and I said, "Wow, that's pretty cool." And she said, "Actually, I really just want to be an astronaut, but I figured that being an astrophysicist would help." And I said, well, it's funny that somebody that's 18 has kind of had that dream all her life that she really wants to be an astronaut.
Yeah.
And even despite the fact that this has all kind of fallen apart on our watch.
Yeah, it kind of has in some ways. I tell you, those astrophysicist types, I spent a lot of time with some of those guys in college, and it's kind of a unique crowd. Some people think we're geeks. Let me tell you.
Yeah, but they don't have slide rules.
No, they don't. They have,
actually, their slide rules are in their head, I think.
They have supercomputers.
Yeah, that's true.
Again, we're joined by Linda Meeks and Jody Bromer. Jody, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with your helicopter future in training?
Well, it started out, you know, just progressing through the certifications, private through CFII. I do have an opportunity to get utility lab in, and actually I'm going to get to fly the Huey with any luck, doing a fire lab. So really, I mean, it's a fantastic deal if you've got the head for it.
Why helicopters?
Well, probably too much Magnum PI growing up. I'm not sure. Well, my grandfather had these fantastic stories. He was a game and fish warden. He had these fantastic stories about how they would, you know, herd these elk into these 6-foot banks of snow so they could jump off the helicopter and tag them and get back on. And wow. It was just, you know, very intriguing. But I never took it seriously that I ever had that opportunity till a couple of years ago.
But you do know the pilot's not supposed to jump out of the helicopter.
the pilot can't even.
Just curious.
You can't even use both hands for anything else. Jeez.
How about you, Linda? You've also flown helicopters and fixed wing. Do helicopters remain your favorite passion?
It's got a special place in my heart, definitely. And it's funny to hear Jody talk about going into Hueys because I went to flight school in 1993, and even then they were saying that the Hueys were going away. And I still flew them on active duty in 94, and then I joined the National Guard and flew them for a couple more years. So the grand old Huey I don't think is ever going to go away.
No. Kind of like
the one we have in the hangar. The one we have in the hangar still has shrapnel.
Yeah.
No kidding. Wow.
Vietnam shrapnel, I promise. Mean,
yeah, the only thing that can replace a Huey is another Huey.
Mm-hmm. They're amazing.
But you know something I wanted to ask you, Jody? I noticed in some of the info that we received prior to the show, you mentioned that you used your GI Bill to help pay for some of the training. How did that all work out? I mean, did they cover – I mean, because I used mine from – a long time ago. But it was really valuable to me. And so I just wondered if you thought it was really a good deal for you as well.
Well, it's, you know, the Montgomery, you get to use 60% of that. I'm sure Linda is familiar with that. And I'm sure that's what you used too, Rob. But, you know, even with helicopters, Part 61, it's still going to cost you $100,000. So that's still $40,000 out of pocket. And then Bush signed in the 9/11 GI Bill that as long as you're getting it with a degree program, they will pay 100% of your flight training. So it's a fantastic deal. The Montgomery, you had to pay for your private pilot yourself, basically to prove that you were competent and that you were serious about it, and then they paid the 60%.
Yeah, and it was, I don't think we called it the Montgomery when I did it, but it was the same basic concept. You had to have a private, and they would cover 90%, though, in those days. So it was a really good deal. But this one, I mean, I would tell any pilot that I talk to when we talk to people on the show, and I tell them, you need a degree anyway. You really do. You'll never go wrong having it. And boy, talk about motivation. Why would you not want to get the degree if they're going to pay for 100% of your flight training?
Well, and I've noticed, I started research a couple years ago, late 2009. And at the time, there was no mention of a degree program for any job application. But now, more and more, I've seen almost every job application require some sort of college education. So it's becoming a thing, that's for sure.
Okay, so let's make it hard here. Linda, what kind of advice would you give Jody as one helicopter lady to another that you wish you'd known about that you scared yourself learning? We don't actually need the when and the where, but you know, everybody has one of those.
Gosh, I've never scared myself in a helicopter. Are you kidding me? No, no, actually, I will admit to when I was a second lieutenant with a very senior warrant officer, and we had gotten up at 2:30 in the morning to fly across Germany, and we were what's the term? Scud running? It was winter, of course, and the helicopter has no anti-ice or de-ice systems, and so we were trying to stay below the clouds. And there's the heating system on the Huey is very primitive, and so basically you just get a stream of hot air just blowing right in your face. And let me just say that it was a good thing that our passenger was also an aviator, and he stayed awake. So that was probably the scariest time ever, is the colonel in the back. I was in a VIP unit. The colonel in the back said something on the radio when I started to doze off as well. And yeah, no autopilot, so there wasn't much room for error there. So I guess my biggest piece of advice is stay awake. Yeah. And I think the statute of limitations has run out on that incident.
Yeah, so you're clear.
Yeah.
Jody, which school are you going to?
Well, my college is a community college here in Salt Lake, and then I'm at Upper Limit Aviation, the flight school, and they operate in partnership.
And the college that you're going to has some activity associated with the Women of Aviation Worldwide Week, is that right?
Well, they're doing Girls in Sciences and Mathematics, and when I went to my dean of aviation to ask her about the International Women of Aviation, she handed me this flyer and said, well, you know, we got this thing going on. Would you, you know, like to piggyback off of that? And really, she was plotting on me all along anyway. So it worked out. It was, I'm going to get to use, they're already doing all of the advertisements, you know, they're going to be bringing the girls in. I just have to show up and be ready to teach.
And what's the sort of the age group of the girls coming in?
It's mostly high school girls, but I think it's open to all women. I'm not entirely sure about that.
Well, the organization has got kind of an interesting history, at least I thought so. It's the Institute for Women of Aviation Worldwide, and it's a independent group. And it was founded by an individual whose name is going to be difficult to pronounce because it's French, and my French isn't all that great, but I guess it's something along the lines of Mireille Goya. And she was looking for events to celebrate the centennial of the first woman to earn a pilot's license, which was in 1910. And she didn't find any events. So she started to launch some of her own, and encouraging pilots to fly it forward. And she did that, but that eventually grew into the organization, the Institute for Women of Aviation Worldwide. And interestingly, I didn't know this, but some folks may, or some of our listeners, I'm sure, know the name Victoria Neuville, who is from the Stuck Mike Avcast. And she's one of the members of the board of directors, so she's involved in that. But I guess the idea is that there are activities, well, really across the world to celebrate this this particular week, which is, let's see, the date that's in March, isn't it?
March 4th through 10th.
Okay.
Yeah.
And a small point, because I think sometimes people get confused about this, it is Women of Aviation Worldwide Week, but the events can only be for a day. It's just that they chose this period of time to really kind of focus the, you know, energy and attention on the organization.
Okay.
And Victoria Neuville, and I don't know how to say her married name, Zayco?
I think,
yeah. Okay. So I'm guessing there, but she's actually the U.S. team leader. So her goal is to get an event in all of the 50 states. So that's what she's really pushing for.
Ah, that's great. That's a real challenge, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Oh, it's that challenge that she passed along to Linda, that Linda passed along through Girls with Wings. That's the only reason I knew anything about this whole week.
And we can mention the website for the organization. It's www.iwoaw.org. And they have a there's a Twitter hashtag too to follow, which is the hashtag is WOAW2013. So folks can follow that on Twitter and also check out that website. I think that'd be good. They have a lot of different resources and a lot of interesting things to help get you know, women, young girls involved in aviation. I'm curious, Jody, what's the makeup of your class like at helicopter school?
Well, class of one, really?
Okay.
Well, I think there's actually two other women, actually. One is very new, and then another one was here when I got here, and she's actually made it through her double I, so she's now instructing. But in my class, my first private pilot ground class, there was me. And really, out of the 20 of us that started, there's only three of us that I know of, and one of them being a woman, me, that have passed their private pilots. So it's stiff competition.
Yeah, I guess so. So do the guys behave themselves, or are they respectful, or do you get a lot of stuff?
Well, I'm a pretty strong-minded gal, so they
don't. I get that impression.
They don't bother me too much.
That's good.
Hey, Jody, what kind of helicopter are you learning to fly in?
Right now, I'm in the Bell 206. I did my private in the R-22 and my instrument, the 44, and I have flown a Long Ranger also. And then, with any luck, I'll get to fly the Huey here shortly.
But you know what I think is really interesting about that is that if you were a commercial airplane student, you wouldn't be flying a turbine machine. I mean, you'd be in a
Archer or something.
Yeah. I mean, so that's really pretty neat because turbine engines are where the world is headed anyway here. So, I mean, you're getting some experience that a lot of other commercial students are not getting.
No, and that's a very strong argument to do the turbine, just because even a couple of years ago, as much as 2011, nobody was requiring turbine time. They were willing to teach it to you, and now that is not the case anymore. And that was as quickly as 8 months that changed.
Wow.
So, Rob, you're saying that training in turbine-powered craft is unusual?
Absolutely. For
yeah, and why is that?
Sure, absolutely. And Jody, I don't know what the hourly rate is on that 206, but it's
got to
be
know?
$500 or $600 an hour. More than that.
Try 12.
$1,200 an hour. Okay.
Yes.
Wow.
And a comparable airplane that would be used for a commercial student airplane fixed wing, as Jody said, Piper Archer, you could do it in, which is maybe 150 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But of course it's a normally aspirated piston airplane, and people get all the way through their instructor certificates on the fixed wing side and have never even started a turbine engine, let alone seen one, most likely. Whereas, by the time she's done, she's going to have quite a bit of turbine experience there.
Huh. Fantastic.
Yeah, you'll know about chip detectors and all that kind of cool stuff.
They have them on the piston aircraft too, but it's definitely more important. You know, where it's a land as soon as practical on a piston, it's a land now on a turbine. So
that's really exciting. I think that's going to be fun.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. Very much. Linda, you're getting ready to make a major change in your life, aren't you?
Just a small change.
What are you up to?
I am moving to the other side of the world.
Oh, yeah, sure. I know. You're moving
not
to
as far
East Coast
as Mars, but no, actually, 12 hours away, literally the other side of the world. I'm going to Hong Kong for my new job as a sim instructor for an airline over there.
Oh.
So actually, you brought up the Airbus, and I'll actually be instructing in the Airbus.
Cool. Now,
so, yeah.
The static or a full motion simulator that you're...
Oh, full motion.
Full motion.
Yeah, absolutely.
320, 330, both?
Yes. And yes. 340, and then eventually 350.
Oh.
Is this training that would be for the pilots of one airline, or is it for others as well?
I don't know all of the specifics yet, but it's for Cathay Pacific Airlines, and they also do the training for Dragonair. And I did hear that they have certain instructors that will do the training for both pilots, you know, both airlines.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still packing up my house.
Oh, my. So you're gonna move. What happens to Girls with Wings?
Girls with Wings, let me adamantly emphasize that it's not going anywhere. Still going to continue the nonprofit. In fact, we are in our spring scholarship session. So we're actually accepting scholarship applications right now. For flight training. So go to girlswithwings.com and check that out. But we'll still be doing the newsletter and the website and the scholarship. So that's not going anywhere. The only thing is for at least the next six months, I'll be heavily involved in my own training. So that means no sun and fun, no Oshkosh, et cetera. But I also, there's quite a bit of vacation time involved in the job. So I will be back. And I don't think, for the most part, we do everything via the internet anyways. I don't think most people will even notice I'm gone.
I think you're being modest, but...
do you have a cat?
I have two cats.
Are they going
with
you?
Them with?
They are going with me, and no, not as dinner.
Wow, clearly that joke...
Clearly,
that joke has been asked a lot.
Quite a few times, actually. Yeah.
Well, no. So you'll be getting typed in then in the that's your initial training is to get typewritten in those airplanes you'll be training in, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, that ought to be fun. Oof.
Yeah, I have a 7-3 type, but that was a long time ago. So apparently, it's kind of I'm trying to think of any. Some PG-13 reference, but just there's kind of a showdown at the beginning of every sim session where you have to again talk about, you know, whip out your ratings and talk about what you have. And so Station 10 pilot, I just might not hold everybody's heavy time, but
yeah, but a 10 is no baby. I mean, everybody knows that's a pretty decent airplane.
Yeah,
so just has the wheel in the wrong place. That's right. All they're going to tell you. Well, that's going to be really, really neat. So when do you start?
In less than a month.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah, so it happened very quickly. I'm still in shock, actually.
Can I ask? Go ahead, Linda.
I was. I wanted to emphasize one thing with the Women of Aviation Worldwide Week is that I know that we were talking about encouraging more women and girls to have an interest in aviation. But I think what's really special about what this organization is doing is they're actually getting butts into seats, and so they're, you know, what they're really targeting think of how many people never have an opportunity to get into a small aircraft. And of course, it's airplanes and helicopters. So what they're trying to do is just really gain some kind of a momentum to get these people to have an actual experience. And maybe that won't convince them to become a pilot or something else, but it might inspire them to do something else. You know, we've all caught the bug for aviation. So that's why I'm really putting the energy of Girls with Wings behind this effort, because they're really putting their money where their mouth is.
Well, that's fantastic. And in fact, we were talking kind of about that concept last week on the last episode, where we said that, you know, as we listen to stories from our listeners about what got them started in aviation or flying or whatever it was, oftentimes there's I called it sort of a defining event or person that influenced them in some way. And it sounds like what this organization is doing is creating a lot of those events for a lot of people.
And it really doesn't have to be anything earth-shattering or, you know, some kind of aviation extravaganza or anything. One of the previous Girls with Wings scholarship winners, she's having a smaller event at where she does her flight training. And because they didn't want to spend a lot of time doing fundraising and everything, she's having the people pay for their airplane ride, but it's being subsidized, obviously. But just a day to get people out to the airport and experience aviation. That's never a bad idea.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, can I ask a quick question before we push these two ladies away? I don't really want to do that, but, you know, I mean,
it's happened.
They did hang up. They did hang up on us earlier. I mean, and they put us on hold and all kinds of really mean stuff, but that's okay. No, but seriously, Linda, when you go to the Far East, are you going to kind of check in with us all through Girls with Wings blog, or are you going to kind of talk about your experiences over there in Asia for the rest of us that aren't there? Or I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
I warned you before, even though you guys hung up on me, I kept talking. Okay.
No, you hung up on us.
I'm still putting information out there, even if nobody's listening to me. So again, Girls with Wings is going to continue. I'm still going to be pushing that effort. And then I have a Girls with Wings blog, which is kind of morphed over the years, depending on what I'm doing at any particular time. But I fully recognize I've gotten so many interesting reactions from telling people that I'm moving to Hong Kong. In fact, I love just telling random people on the street that I'm moving to China, because the people either react with excitement, like, oh, that's so great, you know, I'm so happy for you, or they just look at me like, well, if that's what you want to do. So not only the Hong Kong thing, but also a lot of people don't have any experience knowing about simulators. You guys asked me whether it was full motion simulator, you know, level D simulators. You can do your entire training on an airplane in those simulators, and the first time you fly the actual airplane, you can do so with passengers. That's how good these simulators are.
That's amazing.
So I think, you know, in both aspects of that, I think that I've got a lot of material that I can use on the Girls with Wings blog. So no, you can't shut me up. No way. You can hit mute.
Good.
You can close the window.
Send her halfway around the world.
And I will be back. Well, and the thing is that literally it's 12 hours difference from the East Coast to Hong Kong, actually, daylight savings. But anyway, so, and of course, all simulator instructors get those midnight shifts. So I will probably be most active, you know, what is still going to be daytime in the United States. So, yeah, I'm still going to be here.
Good. So, Linda, tell our listeners again where they can find you and Girls with Wings and all the places they can find that online.
Sure. Right. The website is girlswithwings.com, and I'm also on Twitter at Girls with Wings. And then we have several Facebook pages for Girls with Wings. And just to reiterate, we are in our spring scholarship program window, and that closes March 31st. And then we'll have our summer scholarship program. So please do let people know that we are giving money out for flight training.
Fantastic. Hey, Jody, are you online somewhere?
If anybody's interested, they can always send me an email at j.bromer at Yahoo. But I tried Twitter, and I just didn't quite have an interest in it. But you can always search me on Facebook. There's not
there's only one of me, so you'll find me eventually.
All right, very good.
Hey, Jody, when do you take your check ride for the commercial?
Well, I'm waiting. Unfortunately, I'm spinning my wheels, but hopefully next week the DPE will be back in town so I can take my check ride.
And now here's David Vanderhoof, our official airplane geeks historian, with the aircraft of the week.
Thanks, Max. Well, the airplane geeks airplane of the week, by a vote of 12-6, I think, is the A3J1, or otherwise known as the A5 Vigilante. In the 50s, the U.S. Navy was looking for a nuclear strike bomber to replace the Douglas A3D Sky Warrior. North American Aviation submitted a private study to the Pentagon called the NAGPAW, or North American General Purpose Attack Weapon. The Bureau of Aviation contacted North American Aviation in 1956. That would become the A3J1. North America would name it the Vigilante, and it would fly for the first time on August 31st, 1958, from North American's factory in Columbus, Ohio. The original aircraft was given twin tails and had a large swept wing. To improve lift at low speeds, the aircraft was fitted with boundary layer control flaps, which blew additional air over the flaps to increase lift. The power plant would be the General Electric J79 GE-8, the same engine that powered the Navy's newest fighter, the F4H1 Phantom II. Eventually, twin tails were replaced with a single vertical stabilizer. The vertical stab was mounted on a single pivot point and provided more stability, so the whole tail moved, not just a rudder. It was also so large it was capable of folding in half so it could be stowed below decks. Another innovation of the A3J1 was variable geometry intakes. These intakes assisted the A3J to go Mach 2+. Another way to streamline the aircraft was the implementation of a refueling probe that retracted into the fuselage but with doors. North American team also came up with unique internal weapons carriage system that was also designed to enhance the speed of the aircraft. Lastly, it had a wraparound windscreen that was capable of handling a bird strike at Mach 2. I mentioned before the unique internal weapon system. The A3J featured a linear bomb bay that was located between the two J79s. The logic was, with the linear bomb bay, the aircraft would have a head start avoiding the nuclear bomb it was delivering. The Mark 28 thermonuclear device was sandwiched between two fuel tanks. The Mark 82 RI was equivalent to 1.1 megatons of TNT. The mission profile was that en route to the target, the A3J would burn the fuel out of the tanks attached to the Mark 28. Over the target, the stores train, as it was called, would be fired out the rear of the aircraft. This would cause the bomb to go through a ballistic arc. It would also lighten the aircraft for the Mark II supersonic dash away from the target. The A3J for its day had an extremely advanced cockpit with closed-circuit TV for the bombardier navigator, the first heads-up display for the pilot. It also had a digital computer to calculate airspeed and navigation. The A3J became the A5A with the tri-service designation. The A3 was given to the Whale, the aircraft it was supposedly replacing. The A5B would follow on with the addition of a hump on the back of the fuselage. The hump would carry an additional 460 gallons of fuel. Also, the wing pylons were increased to floor, though most of the time they were never carried. Like many state-of-the-art aircraft, namely the 787, A380, F-22, F-35, the A5 suffered from major teething problems. One, the bomb bay never worked right. Eventually, the bomb was replaced with a third fuel tank. One A5 was lost, though, when it was catapulted down Enterprise's catapult, and the fuel tanks came out the back and caught fire. It was a total write-off. Its electronics were so sophisticated at the time, it had double the man-hours of service compared to what it replaced, the A3. In 1963, the A5 was canceled due to the change in nuclear strategy. Ballistic subs were the Navy's choice for delivering nuclear weapons. The two A5Bs were converted to RA5Cs. The Vigilante then had a new mission. In a clean configuration, the RA5C could keep up or surpass most jet fighters of the era. It was perfect for reconnaissance. A canoe fairing was placed at the center of the aircraft. It had side-looking radar and a variety of cameras. The Vigilante was placed into combat alone, unarmed, and unafraid. The aircraft was so good it was put back in production in 1968 to support combat losses in Vietnam. 23 Vigis were lost over Vietnam. The mission of pre- and post-strike reconnaissance made the Vigi a sitting duck no matter how fast it flew. However, bomb damage assessments brought back to the boat were always invaluable. A second batch of RA-5Cs were given a larger wing and upgraded J-79s. Only 36 of these were completed in the section production run, which ended in August of 1970. The A3J-1 in December 13, 1960, carried a 2,400-plus payload to over 91,451 feet. Overall, 158 aircraft were built, and all but four were converted to RA-5Cs. So that takes care of the Vigilante, and we're going to move on to next week's dogfight. So we're not going to run the roulette wheel because we had a request from the old man of the show. He wants to remember his childhood days. And this week's dogfight will be the Fokker DR-1, the Red Baron triplane, versus Snoopy and his Sopwith with Camel. These were Rob's choices, not mine, folks. So don't forget to vote early and vote often. So we've got the DR-1 versus the Camel. And this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
All right. Thanks, David. Well, that aircraft had a lot of interesting problems along the way.
Yeah, it was a 787 of its day. Caught fire. It had overblown electronics. But like a lot of those aircraft that have technical problems in the beginning, it finds its niche and becomes a very, very successful aircraft.
Hmm.
It's the same vintage as the F-111, you know. I keep telling all these people that the F-35 will be the greatest aircraft known to man because it's having all these teething problems up front. If history ever says anything, you know, the Mustang was a pretty bad airplane until it found a Merlin engine. So
just have to be patient.
These bad airplanes that have these teething problems go on to fly very long lives.
All right. Thanks, David.
Didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 11th of February, 2013.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 235. Grant, I'll tell you what, after all that running around and flying around the world in business class or first class or whatever, well, it seems like you brought back a few germs with you, mate. You've been laid out flat this week with the flu.
Yeah, that's true, mate. I definitely came down with the dreaded lurgy.
In a way, then, that makes me almost glad that I stayed here in Australia.
Yeah, well, there had to be some reason for you not to kill me for getting the gig, hey?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, mate, we've been talking a lot about the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, better known here as the ACCC, and their concerns about Tiger Airways and, you know, being bought out in large part by Virgin Australia. More articles coming out this week. We're reading one here in Australian Aviation Magazine.com.au. And, well, I'll tell you what, they haven't let up the ACCC, Grant. They're still talking about it being a potential duopoly, and they're not happy about it.
Yeah, mate. Well, the ACCC is not really happy about many things, except for Qantas and Emirates. It seems to be happy about that because clearly it's you know, helping Qantas's international arm somehow, but yeah, they're still saying it's got a high chance of creating a duopoly. Personally, I think if it did create a duopoly, well, it'll just create a market opportunity for someone like AirAsia, perhaps, to come in and set up their own little operation here in Australia. Because, hey, domestic, if it's only domestic, you could set up a separate operation, just like Tiger did. And yeah, away they go. So if it does become a duopoly, who cares?
Well, the interesting thing is, Grant, that before Tiger Airways came on the scene, a duopoly is exactly what we had. We had Virgin Blue, as it was known back then, and Qantas. I mean, that's all we had. And Tiger Airways came on the scene, and they've pretty much became the Greyhound bus of the skies.
And don't forget the little one that tried again, the Impulse Airlines, that had a go at it and wound up being purchased by Qantas and made into Jetstar.
not much more to report there, except to say, of course, that Rod Sims, the CEO there of the ACCC, is still saying that he's not happy about it. And I think the longer these negative statements go on, Grant, they're looking at making a decision around the 14th of March. But as the longer this negativity goes on, the worse it is sounding for Virgin and their aspirations to bring Tiger Airways into the fold and, who knows, make actually a airline worth catching. But hey, that's just me.
Oh, don't go there, mate.
I wonder what they do to their complaints resolution department.
Yeah, we're not going there. Because, hey, you know, there was the rumor going around that if this didn't happen, Tiger was going to fold up operations. But you know what? They're still going pretty strong. And in fact, they've introduced some new routes to the red center of Australia. So, yeah, kind of interesting there that they're still trying to expand and make things happen despite this whole decision being in limbo and waiting until March now. So good to see Tiger still trying to carry on. I kind of hope that they do stick around because it's good to have a little destabilizing influence down the bottom end of the market. But I'm sure if they're gone and it's just Virgin, Jetstar and Qantas, then somebody else will step in. It's bound to happen.
You know, Grant, we should start our own airline, Stephen Grant Airlines.
Oh, mate. Nah, you know, I think we should just go and help out Thrombey.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, Grant, Tiger Airways might be sticking around, and Qantas says that it's sticking with Dreamliners despite all the current safety issues.
That's right, mate. On February 7th, Qantas said it remained committed to introducing the Boeing 787 Dreamliner because it's hanging out for the fuel efficiency and so on. So despite the safety issues, they still think they're going to get them in August. This is on 7th of February, and they said, "We haven't been advised of any delay at this stage." And then on the 9th of February comes the headline, "Boeing tells clients of 787 Dreamliner delays." It's going to be very interesting to see where that battery scenario goes. But meanwhile, Qantas haven't come forward on their own and said, yeah, we're pushing back August to a later date. So I don't know, maybe Boeing's hoping to have it all done and they're still building them. So maybe there's going to be this big flood of Dreamliners suddenly get delivered. Yeah. I'll believe that when I see it.
Yeah. You know, Grant, the 777 assembly line is still running, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty good aircraft, that one. The 777's totally in the groove. It's a known product and people know how to operate it and get the most out of it. Just look at Emirates.
Options. Conversion of options. Anyway.
Well, that's what Air New Zealand did. But, you know, it hasn't exactly helped them entirely. But they're pulling back from flights beyond Hong Kong and code-sharing with Cathay. They're in with Qantas. But you know what's interesting on that front, mate? And just to throw one at you from the sidelines, Cathay is taking advantage of Qantas pulling out of many parts of the London route from Hong Kong. And they're stepping up their Hong Kong to London flights and trying to get more Australians to go to London via Hong Kong. While at the same time, Garuda is trying to get them to go via Jakarta. So everyone, even the Chinese with the Canton route, everyone's trying to pick up where Qantas is stepping back. Interesting, hey?
Yeah, interesting, and I'm sure we called that, didn't we, along with many, many other commentators back when Qantas made those announcements a few months back about changing all those routes and restructuring and all that sort of stuff. I know a lot of people were saying, well, you know, really, is that wise, guys? Because there's plenty of other airlines that will step in and fill that gap, and as you say, that's exactly what's happened.
Oh, totally, mate. And speaking of stepping in and filling the gap, well, apparently, Qantas and British Airways are dismissing claims that they're at war over code share arrangements because, of course, now that Qantas is with Emirates, that's annoyed British Airways. Qantas and British Airways, you know, the whole kangaroo route direct up through to London and a very important route that British Airways and Qantas would code share on. Well, the word is that British Airways are going to dump that because they're in a bit of a snit with Qantas going with Emirates. But both airlines are trying to say that's not the case.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, it's hardly it is surprising that they're both denying it, but if there is a bit of angst there, well, I can kind of understand why that is.
Yeah, it's the old world versus the new for now. But, you know, I think these Middle Eastern airlines have to make as much as they can at the moment because who knows, another 5-6 years, maybe 10, and I reckon we're going to have point-to-point from London to Sydney with a viable load against the headwinds.
Well, we'll stay tuned for that one, Grant. And looking over to the other side of Australia and looking out to the Pacific, well, Air Pacific, the old flying fruit tingle, well, they're looking for a new chief executive.
That's right, mate. David Flieger says he's going to leave the airline at the end of his three-year contract on the 1st of May.
Yes, Air Pacific Chairman Nalin Patel said the airline, which is, by the way, 46% owned by Qantas, would immediately begin a recruitment process for a new managing director and chief executive. I tell you what, you know that young kid that used to work on the airplane gigs, yeah?
He could go pretty well. But, you know, this is all part of the change because don't forget they're rebranding to Fiji Airways and no more flying fruit tingle on their logo.
Oh, well, we'll have to find a brand new nickname for them, mate.
I'm sure one will come up.
Now, just a couple of quick ones before we finish here. And our friends up at Brisbane at Aviation Australia, now they do a lot of training, teaching people, amongst other things, how to be flight attendants. And they also do a lot of engineering training up there. A fantastic facility they've got up there at Aviation Australia. Well, Grant, some good news. They're looking like they're going to try and expand overseas. They're traveling to Malaysia this month. That's got a bit of a tie-in with you.
Oh, mate, who knew? But I was there with Malaysia Airlines. They're going over doing some training for Air Asia's engineering students. Now they're actually going over there to do some of it rather than bringing Air Asia engineers over to Queensland.
Now, Grant, the Royal Australian Air Force, our good friends there at the RAF, they've just marked 10 years of Hercules operations in the Middle East.
They started way back in February 2003 with a pair of C-130Hs.
According to this press release here by the Minister for Defence, Stephen Smith, MP, he says, amongst other things, in 10 years, the RAF Hercules have transported over 220,000 passengers and 43,000 tons of cargo to the Middle East and flown more than 4,600 missions.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of hauling, mate, and some interesting milestone missions in there. They were doing airdrops and support for Australian units back in 2003 in Iraq, and one of the RAF C-130Hs was the first coalition aircraft to land at Al Asad Air Base just after it was captured by Australian Special Forces. Pretty good.
Pretty good indeed. And it should be noted too that the Royal Australian Air Force fleet of Hercules at the moment, which only now consists of C-130Js, in no small part thanks to Stephen Smith MP, we only have 12 Hercules now in the Royal Australian Air Force. We did have a fleet of 24. We now only have 12. So that's a mighty effort for a very small fleet of military airlifters. So well done to everybody there in the Royal Australian Air Force who's been involved with that deployment over the years.
Well done, guys. Definitely.
Well, that's everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk. Grant, I've got to get this one ready because, we're busy editing episode 100 of Playing Crazy Down Under, and there's a lot of work to be done.
Woo! Yes, yes. 100 days, 100 nights, and a whole lot more.
Absolutely. Well, I better get busy with that. Until next week, I'm Steve Fisher.
And I'm the editing Grant McCarran. Who knew?
You're editing?
Yeah.
Oh, great. I can take the night off.
Hey, whoa. You're editing your bit. I'm editing my bit. Hey.
Yeah, those guys are coming up on episode 100 of Playing Crazy Down Under. That's a big milestone.
100?
Mm-hmm.
100.
Can you believe it?
Wow. Dude. I wonder if they're going to need any, smart aleck comments on their 100th show. We should talk to them, don't you think, guys?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
You mean smart aleck comments like Australia now has 12? C-130Js, and my dad's C-130 squadron had 14 of them.
Yeah, something like that.
Just to throw that out as a suggestion.
Well, they're on an island.
That's right, Jody. They're on an island.
Tiny island.
The 130. The 130's older than the Huey.
Oh, okay.
Not by much, but.
All right, now let's listen to Peter Johnson with his Across the Pond segment. He's going to describe a recent aviation accident in some interesting detail. So here's Peter.
Today, I thought I'd relay news that's a few weeks old, but I wanted to hear what Rob has to say about it. The story comes from Russia and relates to the crash of the Red Wings Tupolev 204 a month ago.
Our breaking news this hour. A passenger plane has crash-landed into one of Moscow's main highways. The Defence Ministry says 8 people...
When I first read this story, I didn't really take it in. So let me tell you what the initial findings are. The Red Wings aircraft was on a repositioning flight with 8 crew. The pilot in control was Captain Gennady Shemelev. And for those who are not familiar with the aircraft, the flight crew also carried a flight engineer. It had been snowing prior to the accident and there was a significant crosswind with gusts of up to 29 knots. The aircraft, a 204-100B model, was built in 2008. At the time of the accident, the airframe had accumulated 8,672 flight hours in 2,482 cycles. Captain Shemelev had more than 14,500 hours of flying experience, of which more than 3,000 were on the 204.
I hope you made yourself proud.
So, before entering the glide path, the aircraft was correctly configured in the landing configuration with flaps and slats deployed, and the landing gear was down. During preparation for landing, the captain determined the landing speed to be 130 miles an hour and specified that a speed of at least 143 miles an hour be maintained. Descent was done in the director mode with auto throttle disabled. Descent was performed without any deviations from the glide path, and the end of the runway was passed at a height of about 50 feet and an airspeed of 161 miles per hour. 5 seconds after the throttle had been switched to the idle mode, the aircraft landed with a speed of 143 miles an hour. It touched down around 3,000 feet from the threshold and had a left bank of 1 to 1.5 degrees. At this point, the signal for the left gear strut compression was produced. During the landing, the right wing gusts reached up to 38 feet per second. 3 seconds after the left gear touchdown, the nose gear strut was compressed. The right gear had still not compressed. With the touchdown of the nose gear, though, the crew moved the engine controls to the maximum reverse position and applied mechanical brakes. The reversing systems on both engines did not react. Air brakes and spoilers also didn't activate automatically, and the crew didn't attempt to activate them manually. Instead of reverse thrust being activated, an increase in forward thrust at 90% was recorded on both engines. The minimum airspeed to which the aircraft slowed about 7 to 8 seconds after landing was 124 miles an hour. There was still no report of the right gear having compressed. Speed then began to increase. 2 seconds after the thrust levers were moved to the maximum reverse position, the flight engineer reported that the reversers had not deployed. The thrust lever had been maintained in the maximum reverse position for 8 seconds and was then switched off. During this time, though, the aircraft's airspeed increased to 149 miles an hour. The increase in speed led to further unloading of the main landing gear, and fluctuations in roll from 4.5 degrees on the left to 2.6 degrees on the right, compression signals were alternating between left and right gear struts. The signal of simultaneous compression of both struts, which was needed for thrust reversers deployment, did not happen. Almost simultaneously, with the reversers being switched off, the brake pedal was applied by the captain. As before, braking didn't work, as the hydraulic pressure in the wheel brake is only applied after sufficient compression on the gear strut is recorded in the system. 5 seconds after reversers were deactivated, the flight engineer shouted, "Reverse, turn on reverse." The pilots again moved the controls to the maximum reverse position. As with the first attempt, the deployment of the reversers didn't happen. Both of the engines again started to produce direct thrust. Braking of the aircraft again did not happen, and the airspeed started to increase again, back up to 149 miles an hour. The reversers were switched off 4 seconds after that. At this time, the aircraft was 3,000 feet from the end of the runway. The crew again attempted to apply automatic braking. When the aircraft passed the end of the runway, the engine levers were in the small reverse position. The aircraft unfortunately skidded off the runway at a speed of 127 miles an hour. The captain instructed the flight engineer to turn off the engines using the emergency brake. The plane collided with the slope of a ravine at about 118 miles an hour. Unfortunately, 5 of the 8 crew were killed, with the remaining 3 seriously injured. My condolences to all those involved in this terrible incident. So, it'd appear that applying full-on reverse thrusters may not work in this situation. So, Rob, my question is this common on modern airliners? And I don't want to be a smart aleck, but how did the designers, the testers, and in fact experienced air crews miss all of this?
Wow, this is a pretty unusual accident report. Well, let me begin with a really important point, that it's very easy for Annie and all of us to sit here and Monday morning quarterback what a crew did or did not do in a situation like this. We only know what the cockpit voice recorder recorded, which are the voices, and what the flight data recorder recorded, which is the movement of the controls and where the how the engines were performing or not performing. But the one thing that's missing is we don't have a camera in the cockpit, so we don't actually know all of the details. We won't know exactly, and I don't think I heard Peter mention, which of the two pilots aboard was actually flying. We're assuming it was the captain, but it may not have been. And we also do not know what other people were doing in the cockpit when the airplane touched down. But here are a couple of things that, to me, sound very odd. Peter referred to the reference speed, the speed they should be touching down at, as 130 miles an hour. That means the reference speed, the speed they should have been flying the final approach at for the last few miles, would have been roughly 30% on top of that at that 143 mile an hour figure. But Peter mentioned that they crossed the runway threshold at 50 feet above the runway, but at well over 160 miles an hour. Now, that puts them 30 miles an hour fast, and that is very, very unusual. Of course, that would make the airplane float down the runway, which is probably why they touched down 3,000 feet down the runway, even allowing for a little extra speed for the wind. But again, now remember, as they were touching down, the wind would have been from the right. So the flying pilot should have been trying to hold the right wing down as the right main touched and then allow the left main to touch and then the nose gear. But what was recorded was that the left main touched first and then the nose gear, and there seems to be quite a bit of confusion about when and if the right main ever touched down. But here's what we do know. Without both main gear planted firmly on the runway, the thrust reversers would not work. And without the both main gear being planted firmly on the runway, the speed brakes would not have come out. So that just kept the airplane moving along way too fast, eating up that 7,000 foot of runway that was left. But again, something that just doesn't quite make sense are those places where they said the speed was actually increasing. That's something I don't understand. That will probably have to wait for the final report. But of course, all the time that the aircraft should have been slowing, it was not. And again, we still do not know why. We don't know why they were not able to use the aircraft's emergency brakes. We also don't know why flying pilot chose not to just shove the throttles all the way forward and go back around and try to come back for another landing. But finally, as I was listening to all this, I was trying to imagine how the airplane could have started to speed up once it had touched down the runway. They did say they tried to pull the thrust levers into reverse. Now, of course, for people that may not understand how that works, when you pull the engines into reverse on a jet, it opens up a set of clamshells on the back of the engine, and then the engine spools up. It increases in RPM, but forces all the thrust that would normally go backwards to go forwards, and that's how it slows the airplane down. But now, what if, as they said, the clamshell doors didn't open, but perhaps the engines spooled up anyway? That could possibly explain the increase in speed. We're not sure. There's just so many items here that just don't seem to make any sense. But I'd like to end my two cents with another thought. It's something I mentioned earlier. Without cockpit video recorders, there's that last piece of the puzzle that we just don't have. Again, we don't know who was moving, trying to do one thing, perhaps interfering with someone else, who was turning around, looking at someone, waving, reaching across to grab something. We only know when someone actually flipped a switch or did something to change some parameter that was recorded on the cockpit voice and the digital data recorders. But again, I think the time is probably coming when we're going to start seeing video recorders to make sure that these airplane accidents are fully explained.
These things are like a puzzle, like a giant puzzle.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's why, but again, an interesting part of this whole story, and we hear this all the time, and I don't want to belabor it, but we have copied voice recorders, and people have often said, well, why don't we have video recorders?
Yes.
We have video recorders in trains and other things, but of course the union doesn't want to have anything to do with that because they're afraid that it's going to start being used in disciplinary issues. But mm-hmm. you don't have the full picture of what was going on only listening to the voice.
Yeah.
Could it possibly be wind shear? Maybe, Rob? What do you think? Have you experienced that?
Well, I have. And of course, I guess one issue that is a wind shear or a wind shear event, if it happens 50 feet off the runway, I mean, I can only tell you what I would have done. I mean, with a 10,000-foot runway, I'd have jammed the throttles forward and gone around. Because yeah. I thought, hey, even if the airplane was still in the descent and it touched down, so what? We still had 10,000 feet in front of us. And again, this was not a short runway. So they were in trouble for quite a long time. And see, again, what were they doing? We only know what they told us they were doing. We don't actually know physically what they, what was going on, what lights may have been flashing. So that's the part that's really missing, and that's why I think that's going to change.
All right. Interesting. All right, Rob, you mentioned earlier something about making a little appearance on a new podcast, I believe.
Well, I had such a fun night last night. I was out at Signature Flight Support at Chicago Executive Airport, and a couple of guys from our flying club have started their own podcast. Of course, I let them know early on that, if they got really good, of course, we would come in and take care of them. But as long as they're still just getting going, we would allow the process to go on. And then, of course, I told them my name was David Vanderhoof. And then I gave them your phone number, David. So, but seriously, the two guys from Leading Edge Flying Club, which I talk about quite a bit, Al Waterloo and Mark Gepner, invited me to join them on their podcast last night, and we had such a good time talking about learning to fly and why people learn to fly, why they don't learn to fly, and all the barriers that have popped up over the past few years that are keeping people from flying, and how valuable the flying club world is starting to become. And so I did a quick interview with them, and I just wanted some of our listeners from around the globe to hear a few of the insights that these two guys had. So let's go now to Signature Flight Support at Chicago Executive Airport, and I'll introduce you to these two guys.
Well, I had some kind of incredible fun time last night over at Chicago Executive Airport. I was hanging out at Signature Flight Support with a couple of guys from our Leading Edge Flying Club. For once, we weren't actually flying. These two guys have put together an aviation podcast that I think really will tell Jetwine and Airplane Geeks listeners problems we're facing here in the aviation industry in the United States. I started right off with a couple of introductions. So let's give it a listen.
So first, on this side, let's see, what's your name, young man?
Mark Gepner. We are at Signature Flight Support at, you choose to call it Chicago Executive, I'll call it Pewaukee. Most people call me the president.
And then we've got this other guy over here in Leading Edge Flying Club as an instructor, as am I. And who are you, young man?
Hey, I'm Al Waterloo.
Of course, we're all pilots. And let me tell you why we're here, because they invited me to be on their podcast. And they run a podcast here at Chicago Executive at Simple Flight Radio. URL is simpleflight.net. Whose idea was Simple Flight? Mark is pointing at Al. So, whoa. Al, yeah. What? Tell me about this.
Well, it was a pure pilot ADD moment. All of a sudden, I just woke up and was like, let's see if simpleflight.net is available as a domain. And it was an impulse buy. And then it all of a sudden, it turned into another pilot ADD moment to do a little podcast radio show.
And it's not really that difficult to start a podcast, is it?
No, not at all, actually. You know, if I can do it, anybody can.
And Mark, how did you get involved in this?
Actually, it was 1 week after Al started this. And I don't even call it a podcast, by the way. It's a live aviation radio show. And
you can
catch us on iTunes or even at simpleflight.net in an archive fashion. He had started the radio show sitting in a hotel room during Oshkosh by himself. And then the next week, he called me up and asked if I wanted to be a co-host. And I had just started what I'm now calling my aviation sabbatical. I left my job to start doing stuff aviation. So the timing was perfect. And every Sunday night, we've been here since.
So tell me, why does Simple Flight Radio exist?
Why does it exist? Well, the fun thing to do...
I want to know your mission statement.
Well, while you're here, it's finding amazing people doing amazing things in aviation.
And you realize that when people hear that, they're going to go, what are you doing with Rob there? I mean, okay. So you started the last week in July, and you're doing this every week, and you're doing it live where we do a tape and blend it all together. What would you tell somebody that wants to start a podcast that's an aviation geek? Any advice?
Definitely go out there and do it, because it's a lot of fun. People will listen. I can't believe it. We actually have listeners, which makes it a lot of fun. And you know, it puts you out in front of cool people, and you get to kind of navigate a scene in aviation that most people don't even realize exists.
I think that's one of the reasons we've been doing it, too, is that we get to meet so many cool people that tell us about incredible stories that we would have never heard before. And Mark, you mentioned before, I didn't want to forget that you're out doing aviation stuff.
It started with just the flying club wanting to make it better, but I've found all kinds of opportunities. You know, Al talks about finding amazing people doing amazing things in aviation. And behind that is this idea that we're hearing all these negative aspects about the pilot population declining and GA being in trouble. And Al and I are in violent agreement, as we like to say, about the positives in aviation. And so it's kind of like, get the word out. There's a lot of great things about aviation, and we just need to, it's going to be up to us to pull us up by the bootstraps and make things go in the right direction, and I think we're doing that.
One other thing I wanted to talk about with you, Mark, is how the aviation industry needs more social reach, it needs more political outreach. It's just, you know, we need to get out there and convince more people that they need to be involved. We haven't really done a very good job of that, I don't think, have we?
Well, probably not, but we really haven't needed to until recently, because we were going along and everything was just fine, and then all of a sudden we needed to change and we didn't. The world around us changed and we didn't react to that.
Point. I don't think we've reacted to that very well. And, you know, you mentioned something earlier about, we talked about glass airplanes and technology, and you made an interesting point.
Well, yeah, I think the point is, and we've read in the news so much about pilots losing their skills because they're so dependent on the autopilot, and it's really the same with the industry. We've gotten kind of in a rut, and we're just going along, if you will, as an industry on autopilot. We need to get back and hand fly this thing. Otherwise, we are out of control and something else is.
One of you, tell me again where people that want to listen to Simple Flight can find you guys.
Well, you can go to simpleflight.net, and there's a link to our live aviation radio show. It's every Sunday night, 8 p.m. Central Time, which I think is 0200 Zulu. You can look us up on iTunes if you missed the show, or go to our archive page.
Well, I think this is a really great idea that you have here. To me, I tell everybody it's radio, because that's what it is. So, guys, thank you so much, and I think it's time to get this show of yours on the road. Do you have something that you sort of started off with? Is there a cheer or a yell or something? Or
the goosebumps on the back of the neck. The turbine engine starting.
It's going to be fun. So let's get going, and thanks for having me tonight.
Yeah.
For Jetwine and the Airplane Geeks in Chicago, I'm Rob Mark.
All right, thanks, Rob. We do have a few emails from listeners, but we're running a little bit long, so I think we're going to hold those until next week. So we want to thank Jody for joining us. You know, it's really great to have a listener on as a guest, Jody. I hope your little peek behind the curtain here has been kind of fun and maybe illuminating.
It has. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
And you're supposed to swear an oath not to say anything about what you've heard behind the scenes.
What did I hear? I didn't hear anything.
That's there we
good
go.
Good girl. Huh?
Jody's good. We also want to thank Linda Meeks for joining us. She's the executive director of Girls with Wings. You can find that site at girlswithwings.com. As always, we want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. You can find them at plaincrazydownunder.com. And also Peter Johnson. You can find him on Twitter as Nascot Hornet, and also on his Facebook page, XTP Media. And of course, at his Aviation Extended podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell everybody where they can find us online. And Rob, Mark, we'll start with you.
Well, since I'm so shy and afraid to speak most of the time, I remind people that they can find me at jetwine.com and jetwine on Twitter and jetwine on Facebook and I don't know, who knows, other places that are yet to be determined.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, and you can also find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, and I don't know, Google Plus, look for us on Airplane Geeks and I don't know, wherever else on the internet.
Okay. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter. It's Max Flight. You can also find me at my aviation directory. That's 30,000feet.com. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 235. You'll find links there to all the sites we mentioned. We're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast right to your mobile phone. And if you want to send us an email, we have an address for that. It's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, we also have our listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet will give you that number.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Bye, everybody. Bye.
Should I start and stop my recorder, too, or should I just give you the file as one long file?
Why don't you stop and start it? Is it easy for you to stop and start it?
See, I just go over here, and I hit this. Where's the little button? I hit the little button. I go, stop, little machine. It goes, stop. And then I hit it again, and it goes, start. Look at that. See, that was easy.
You're brilliant, Rob.
I know.
You're scaring me.
I know. It's this is what our life is like.
I know.
Again, we're joined by Linda
this
Meeks.
That's why nobody wanted to be in an FBO with me. I used to get the place to myself. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
All right. Thanks, David.
Can I ask an old man? Oh, never mind.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize you were good. That's all right. I was going to say that... The World War One airplanes, I just thought it'd be kind of fun. I mean, I don't want people to, you know, we don't have to do that. I was just.
Oh, you don't have to get defensive, Rob. I mean, I think it's a great idea.
I'm not getting defensive. If I was getting defensive, my voice would go up.
And now, I would, Rob,
you know,
I could have asked you what it was like to fly either one of them, but I just didn't go that route.
Yeah, be lucky.
Okay, I'll just sit here and be quiet.
Go. Wrong button, Steve.
I'm sorry about that. It's a new computer, mate. I haven't got a soundboard loaded on it yet.
Thank God for that. I'm safe.
Yeah, temporarily. Yes, the old sound effects machine has bitten the dust after 6 years of trusty service.
Ah, come on. Just hook it up to an external monitor. It'll be fine.
It's been hooked to an external monitor for the last 2 years because its own monitor didn't work. In a way, then, that makes me almost glad that I stayed here in Australia.
Yeah, I think you probably, yeah. How the hell do I answer that?
You can't.
Hey, Max, you know, I was going to say, now you were playing the recording of Stephen Grant, weren't you?
Yeah, no, they're standing right next to me here in my living room.
No, do you guys, should we go on with something else, or do you guys just want to hang on for like 20 seconds?
Well, if it's 20 seconds, we can hang on.
Yeah, okay, where's that part? Okay, I'm just listening to her.
Welcome to Jody, welcome to podcasting with Rob.
Does he segue it often?
Yeah. No, you know, Dan used to do that a lot.
Well, because I was trying to think while I was doing it.
Yeah, you were trying to think on your feet, and that was kind of tough. So, yeah, if you want to do that.
I'm actually on my butt sitting, but I understand what you meant.
Okay.